So about 2 weeks ago, we had what we call a worship and testimony service in Stellenbosch. That's the church where we come from. Normally I try and explain to the people we're having a worship and testimony service, and to a certain extent we're going to have that this morning as well. If time allows. But I asked him, so what does it mean if we're going to have a worship and testimony service? The worship part, I think most of us understand, and kind of had a school of worship here this weekend, so hopefully you guys know a little bit more about worship. But what do we mean by the second part of that term, the worship and testimony service? And let's quickly go and have a look at that definition there. To that next slide. Definition of a testimony is a formal written or spoken statement, especially one given in a court of law. Some of the synonyms there is evidence, a sworn statement, affidavit, attestation. There are more descriptions there. But I like this one. It's a public recounting of a religious conversion or experience. So when you're giving a testimony, it's a public recounting. That means somebody is basically testifying of some type of experience that they've had. Okay, so when we're going to have a worship and testimony service, it means we're going to have worship, which we just did, thanks to the band that led us in amazing worship now. But it also means that some of us have got something to say and that there are stories to be told. And so I've titled this short little message, Becoming Storytellers. And what I'm wanting us to do now is just to go and have a look at some Scripture. You know, the Bible is full of amazing testimonies and stories, just of God's goodness, of His greatness, of His provision, of His deliverance, you know, of His character, His nature. The Bible's full of those stories, especially the Psalms. The Psalms are so rich, they're so soaked in testimonies and stories of God. And one of those stories that I've been spending a lot of time on recently is Psalm 78. And if we can just read those first few verses together. Sure, that's quite small. I'll read it for you, yeah. Psalm 78, it's a contemplation of Asaph. We'll learn a little bit later who Asaph was. And Asaph's writing here, "Give ear, O my people, to my law. Incline your ears to the words of my mouth. I will open my mouth in a parable. I will utter dark sayings of old, which we have heard and known, and our fathers have told us. We will not hide them from their children, telling to the generation to come the praises of the Lord and His strength and His wonderful works that He has done. For He established a testimony in Jacob and appointed a law in Israel, which He commanded our fathers that they should make them known to their children, that the generation to come might know them, the children who would be born, that they may arise and declare them to their children." And so, so what I'm wanting us to do is just go on a little bit of an expository journey here around this psalm. And let's unpack it a little bit here. And so we see it's a psalm that's written by Asaph. So who was Asaph? Asaph is one of the three Levites of the Levitical tribe, one of the three Levites David appointed to minister in song as one of the singers in basically in the court. So basically he's what we would call a modern day worship leader. So that's Asaph. And Asaph is writing and he's saying, "Give ear, O my people, to my law. Incline your ears to the words of my mouth." Basically, what he's saying in today's language, is saying, "Everybody, listen up. I got something to say. Can I asseblief almal se aandag kry? Ek wil iets met julle deel. Can I have your ears, please?" Okay, that's verse one. Wow, that's quite a bit bigger. Okay. It's big like the stakes here in Namibia. Okay, so then he's saying, "I will open my mouth in a parable. I will utter dark sayings of old." So what is he saying in 2016 language? He's saying, "I'll open my mouth in my parable. I'm going to tell you a story here. Ga vir julle story vertel. I will utter dark sayings of old." Now that part confused me. So I went to a couple of commentaries around the Bible and people who had written stuff about the Psalms. And what the commentaries are saying is when he's speaking about, "I will utter dark sayings of old," they're saying a lot of the poets got quite poetical, or the psalmist got quite poetical in Iraq lyricism. So he's using expressive language to basically line us up for an epic story. So imagine in a story like I asked this weekend. Who's seen Braveheart here? Braveheart. Okay, most of you, the older folk. Okay, so the younger people, there was this epic story called Braveheart about 15 or 20 years ago. Still my ultimate movie. But basically at the beginning of Braveheart, you know, it starts with kind of like a violin there in the back. And then on the screen, the fine white print comes up, you know. And there's this voiceover that reads something like, "In the year of our Lord, 1314, patriots of Scotland, starving and outnumbered, charged the fields of Bannockburn. They fought like warrior poets, they fought like Scotsmen, and they won their freedom." Now, I'll try that in my Scottish accent, but I think you'd laugh at me. But basically, that's a modern-day version of what Asaph is doing. He's saying, I've got the story to tell you, and I'm going to utter dark sayings of old. And then he starts unpacking the Psalm 78 for us. And it's an incredible psalm. It's quite a long psalm. But he basically recounts the story of the Exodus and everything that happened to God's people through the desert, and how they rebelled against him, and how God got cross and frustrated with them, and then how he had mercy on them, and how they sinned again, and then he let them fall by the sword, and then he'd have mercy on them. Basically telling the story about God and his people. And of course, if you go to, I think it's that fourth slide in Exodus chapter 15, we pick up the story of where basically this narrative is told, and it's the song of Moses. And I'll read it there for us quickly. It says, "Then Moses and the children of Israel sang this song to the Lord and spoke, saying, this is a different version, okay. "I will sing unto Jehovah, for he hath triumphed gloriously. The horse and his rider hath he." If you can just put up my version, that'll be good. Thanks, man. I'm familiar with that one. "The horse and its rider he has thrown into the sea. The Lord is my strength and song, and he's become my salvation. He's my God, and I will praise him. My father's God, and I will exalt him. The Lord is a man of war. The Lord is his name. Pharaoh's chariots and his army has cast into the sea. His chosen captains also are drowned in the Red Sea, and the depths have covered them, and they sank to the bottom like a stone." Now, this is one of the first songs, apparently, that's written or expressed in the Bible. It's the Song of Moses. And I often use this this song as part of our school of worship. We had the Spirit and Truth School of Worship here this weekend. And one of the sessions that we do is around songwriting. And we speak a little bit about songwriting and what it means to be a songwriter. And then I take them to this first song in the Bible that we read about. And we try and understand it, and we try and analyze it and break it down. And I ask the guys, what do you think is the most important word in this whole song? It's a significant song. It's one of the first songs in the Bible. What do you think in that song there? What do you think is the most important or significant word? And I'd like to ask you, as the Swakop congregation this morning, wat dink julle is die belangrikste woord in daai liedjie? This is where you're allowed to talk in church. So you can have a quick scan through. I'll give you about 20 seconds, and then I'd like some answers. Word. I'm looking for one word. Okay, I've got some takers. Let's start. Triumph. Yes, that's a strong word. Salvation. Yes, linking to triumph. Two. Wait. I understand that one. Two. Where's two? Yes. Speaking about the Lord. Name of God. Yes. I still don't have the answer that I want. Praise. Praise is a good exalt. Lord. Okay, you guys are doing great, but you don't have the answer. Okay. According to me, at least, okay? So this is not necessarily the right answer, but for me, the most important word here in the context of songwriting is the very first word, then. Why do I say then? Because something's just happened. Okay, something's just happened that's causing them to respond and to think, okay, maybe now's a good time to write and sing a song. Okay, so basically what we have to do is we have to understand context. And context is a very important thing when you're writing a song. Because we very often write a song from an experience or a place. And the guys will say, man, I went through this experience, or I broke up with my girlfriend, or I don't know, you went through something, you read a good book or you read the Bible or you watched the epic movie and then you stirred and you something, you know, is burning inside you and you just got to put pen to paper and write a song. So context is, it's this whole thing about where's the source of your inspiration, okay? So let me tell you about the first song I wrote. There's a song for my dog that died. Now, it's actually quite traumatic, but but I'll share it with you anyway. So we got this dog when I was about, I must have been about 15 years old. And for some reason, we four boys, you know, growing up as four boys, for some reason, my parents or my mother thought the appropriate dog for a family with four growing boys is a little French poodle, okay? What's worse is they decided to call this little French poodle, wait for it, Monsieur, the little French poodle, Monsieur. Okay, apparently it means Mister. First, they had it wrong, and his name was for a year or two, Bonjour, which is actually, I think, goodbye or hello in French or something, but good morning. So my folks, or I think it is, yeah, my folks thought that Bonjour was Mister, and so poor little Monsieur went through a bit of identity crisis after about a year or two when his name changed from Bonjour to Monsieur. But anyway, so little Monsieur arrived there at our house and he had a little red bow in his hair. And I mean, he was a grand little thing. I mean, his parents were champions and my parents got him at some breeders there in Pretoria and he had the papers and the, what these, what's the, not pedigree. He was pedigree, it was the real deal, okay? And he arrives there and he's tiny, man, he's like this. And he got these four youngsters looking at him like this, you know, youngsters that are full of mud and dirt and just playing and like, Mom, what are we going to do with this little thing, you know? And so little Monsieur had to grow up very quickly, which he did. And we were just totally into ball sports as boys. And of course, then he needed to get into ball sports as well to be part of the family. And so he actually did quite well. And he really enjoyed, you know, kind of playing with us and he grew quite quickly. And, you know, we would kind of play rugby with him, you know. And we'd got him a little blue French jersey. And we'd be the Springboks and we'd put the blue French jersey on him. And then obviously he'd get tackled a little bit and sometimes quite a lot. And then sometimes when, you know, we felt sorry for him, we bought him a little Springbok jersey. And this is a true story. You can go ask my parents. He had a little Springbok jersey and a little French jersey. And sometimes he'd play with us and then he'd be on the Springbok side. And anyway, so what we would do once or twice a year, we had a family farm in the Karoo, and we'd go up as a family to the farm, and we had one of these VW combis, good Volkswagen combis. We had about four or five of those as I was growing up, and you know, those were the seats that could go back nice and flat, so it'd make a bed there at the back, and that was our rugby field, okay? Before the days that kids wore safety belts. And so we'd have this rugby field there, and we obviously four boys, so it was 2-on-2. And so basically you had this kind of rugby game, and how it worked is you had a tennis ball, and you had to try and score, you know, on kind of your field. And so you kind of had one dive to get through the defense and score a try. And little Monsieur also got into this game. So the favorite part of the whole story was when he'd get the tennis ball and his technique was really good and he'd kind of lunge through the air to try and score a try and we'd kind of take him down mid-air and then just kind of put him down. You'd feel kind of the breath kind of blowing out of his little ribs and kind of just short of the ribs cracking. I see some of you are shaking your head. This is a true story. So this is, you know, the SPCA, it's our they would have been traumatized if they saw what was happening. But Monsieur survived, no broken legs or ribs or anything. And we actually loved this dog, you know, believe it or not. And so we get to our farm on this one day, and we decide to go and visit family friends on the neighbor's farm. And they got big dogs, and we decide, no, we're not taking the risk. We're going to leave our little French poodle on the farm. And so we drive off in our combi and we go over the mountain and we're told afterwards that the little French poodle escaped from the farmhouse and started running up the gravel road past the people and into the veld. Now, this farm was It's in the northeastern Cape in a town called Maltino. It's got the coldest recorded temperature in South Africa, minus 20, okay, in the middle of winter. So we're there in June, July, and it's freezing. We arrived back that night, and much to our dismay, our dog is gone, and the servant ladies that there said, you know, he just ran after you guys. We don't know what happened. And so we start driving around looking for him, and then night comes, and then you realize, okay, chances of him surviving a night out in the veld is pretty slim. You know, he's not one of those big poodles. He's tiny, this big. And so, yeah, for about 2 or 3 days, guys, it was kind of, it was quite traumatic. We'd kind of, you know, go out in the mornings and have a little search party and walked all over the veld. And I remember just walking up the mountain, kind of coming over the mountain and having this Rocky moment. You guys remember Rocky the boxer? Where he screams and I shouted for my little dog and I went, Monsieur! And I'm crying and my little dog is gone. And, you know, after a while we realized little Monsieur is not coming back. And I just started playing the guitar then. And so I went into the one room and I started writing a song for my little dog. I can't really remember how it goes, but it was sad. I'm sitting there, I think, on about the third day that he's gone, and I'm singing his songs. I remember it like yesterday, and Trane in die oë, and I'm singing. The song was called Ode to Monsieur. And I'm sitting there, and I'm singing Ode to Monsieur. And all of a sudden, we kind of hear the servant lady shouting, Die hond is hier, die hond is hier. And the whole family runs out, and so far as vrachtig, there's a guy. They had come on horseback, one of the neighboring farms laborers had come on a paard, and he saw sit Monsieur hier in sy overall, and hy haal die hondjie so uit en hy gee hom terug vir ons. And man, but it was a different little dog, eh? It was like he got 30 years older overnight, and his little eyes were completely glazed over like this, and sy pootjies was so opgeswel, jy weet, just from walking so far in the veld. So kind of when he tried to walk, he initially looked a little bit like this. He was walking a little bit like that. And and so what we did is we had to feed him bar once. I see some of you are staring at me as if I'm telling lies. This is a true story. Confirm my parents. We fed him bar once just to get his energy levels up, and eventually little Monsieur became Monsieur again, and the family went on. And the reason why I'm telling you the story is because that's the context that I wrote one of my first songs from. It was that place of brokenness of a 15-year-old having lost his dog. And I mean, back then, you know, that was a major deal. You know, when you're a kid and your dog dies, it's like a family member dying. And so that's where I wrote that first song. And so to come back to this issue of context in Exodus chapter 15, you know, Moses and Miriam, they're not writing a song about some little dog that died. They've gone through something way more hectic. And so let's just look at the context from which they wrote that song. And then you're going to understand why I'm saying that for me, the most important word there is then. Okay, if we go to that next slide quickly. So let's just look at the context of this song. Okay, so we've got 430 years of oppression. Okay, Joseph was amazing Israelite in Egypt. The king knew him. He was blessed. He was, he's the Hebrews multiplied. But the next Pharaoh didn't know them, gets threatened by the Hebrews that are growing so much, and basically he puts them into slavery. And we're not talking about type of apartheid number of years of slavery. We're talking about 430 years. I mean, it's 500 years of slavery, of oppression, of backbreaking work, okay? Eventually, God raises up this deliverer, Moses. And so the big showdown starts. And the story of Exodus is really a showdown between God and the hardness of heart of a king. And we can learn so much from it. And so we know the story. God tells Moses, go to Pharaoh and say, let my people go. And so Moses goes down there with Aaron. And he shouts out to Pharaoh there on the Nile and says, let my people go. And basically Pharaoh laughs him off. And so the big showdown starts, okay? And God tells Moses, take your staff and strike the Nile. And as he strikes the Nile, an entire river, it's like the Orange River, man, an entire river turns into blood, okay? Warm, sticky blood All the stone pots where their water is stored at home, all the water in the stone pots turns to blood. The word says that the water that was in the wooden bowls in their houses, it turns to blood. For 7 days, there is no drinking water in Egypt. Okay, I think the nations, we've got their attention. You know, most of us can fast for kind of 1 day or 3 days, you know, but when you're talking about 7 days without water, it starts getting pretty intense. The only problem is Pharaoh's magicians can do the same miracle, and so they do the same miracle. After 7 days, the Egyptians start digging wells and they get water again, and kind of Pharaoh relaxes, okay? So God starts the next plague, and so frogs start coming up out of the Nile. Frogs everywhere. Word says frogs in their beds, frogs in their ovens, in their kneading bowls. There's frogs literally wherever you look, okay? Again, the magicians match the miracle. Pharaoh relaxes. The next miracle is that of lice. And the word says that as much as there was dust lying around in the land of Egypt, that dust turned to lice. And the lice crawled up onto people and onto animals, and they were tormented. Until they cried out and they said, please, just take this plague away from us. Pharaoh's magicians could not match that miracle. Yet his heart is hardened, and two more plagues. There's swarms of flies everywhere, like flies like we haven't seen. Eventually, all their livestock dies. Okay, we're talking about an economy that's dependent. It's something like Namibia, where livestock is a big deal. All the livestock dies. Okay, we're talking about the stock exchange of that day typically gets wiped out. Massive financial losses. Yet Pharaoh's heart is hardened, and God is hardening it, and then Pharaoh is hardened. The next plague is boils that break out on the people. Moses is told, take some soot from a furnace, throw it up into the air in Pharaoh's court. And as the soot falls, it kind of blows all over Egypt, and the magicians start breaking out in boils, and they cry out again for deliverance. And yet Pharaoh doesn't let the people go. Then God says to Moses, tell Pharaoh, I'm going to send a really bad plague now so that I can get your attention. And I think it's for 2 or 3 days. It basically hails, massive hail balls and fire throughout the land. And God gives them a warning, says everything that's left outside, your servants, your livestock, anything that's left outside is going to die. Some people listen, some people don't listen. A lot of people die. But basically the nation is pulverized by hail for a couple of days. Eventually Pharaoh calls Moses and says, please, you have to stop this. And Moses pleads God and says, please, stop this. And it's as if Pharaoh's just not getting it. He's kind of moved to that place where he cries out for deliverance, and then God hardens his heart. And we're going to see that play off between how God was hardening his heart. The next plague is locusts. So the east wind blows in locusts. The word says like there's never been a swarm in Egypt. From border to border, the ground is black with locusts. And everything that the hail is not damaged, the locusts eat up. So much so that the word says there was not one green leaf left in the nation of Egypt. Imagine looking outside here or going from, what's your south border? Noordoever, or what's that place called? Noordoever to the top, Rundu or wherever. And traveling for a day or two and not seeing not even a blade of grass. We're talking about nothing green is left. We're talking about multiple national disasters. We're talking about, I don't know what kind of level state of emergency they've declared by this time now. Disaster after disaster after disaster follows, okay? And then there's an interesting one. There's 72 hours of darkness. And I kind of prayed around this and I said, God, why darkness? There's been such hectic things where people are just dying, and you know, there's so much trauma here, and then there's just darkness for 3 days. Well, what's so bad about that? And I could be wrong, but the thing that I felt God saying to me, the word is saying it was gross darkness, so that they were basically immobilized. You know, it's like you can't see your hand in front of your face, so that the word says that they were all stationary. They couldn't go anywhere because of the darkness. Now imagine after 8 plagues like that, you have to sit for 72 hours in gross darkness. And I'm thinking, okay, maybe they would start thinking, what the heck is going on here? You know? Because by now it's obvious that there's a clear distinction between what's happening in Egypt, and in Egypt there's a subsection called the land of Goshen where the Hebrews stay, And there's none of these disasters. God is drawing a line down the center. He's saying, Egyptians, I want you to see I'm striking you with all these signs and wonders, but my people in your country, they're exempt of all these disasters. And I cannot help but to think that they must think something is not right here. King, there's something not right here. I mean, look what we've been through. Our people have died. Our livestock has died. Our nation is basically wiped out. And yet the same people in the same country, there's nothing wrong with them. The problem is obviously to do with them. And I think they would have thought that. And yet God says one more wonder and sign that he strikes the nation with. And it's a very sad sign. It's basically 12 o'clock that night. Angel of the Lord goes in. And every firstborn person and animal in the nation of Egypt dies at 12 o'clock that night. We've kind of become accustomed to, the firstborn dies. But you start having kids and you imagine you were an Egyptian. 12 o'clock at night, your lady or your eldest daughter is no more. All of a sudden, your neighbors start screaming. And then their neighbors start screaming. In fact, the whole road starts screaming. Then the whole neighborhood starts screaming. Then entire provinces and then eventually an entire country is wailing because in every house someone has died. And the word says there's never been such a wailing as that day or that night in Egypt. And, you know, obviously we serve the God of the Hebrews, but for a moment, as I'm thinking about this story, my heart goes out for the Egyptians. Just the massive loss. I mean, imagine the burials the next day or the next week. How many? Hoeveel mense moes hulle begrawe in daai land? And so I would say, you know, they've been through a pretty intense 10 plagues. And then God saves the final, kind of the most impressive miracle for last. And eventually, the king's official just said, just please, can you not see that the nation is in ruins? Just get these Hebrews out of here. We cannot take it anymore. And he says, just the king eventually begs them. The Pharaoh says, just get out of this land. Get out of this land. And they go. And we see a couple of days later, God hardens Pharaoh's heart again. And they go after the Israelites again. And they get to the Red Sea. And people, this is a sermon by itself. I mean, just the kind of the science and the physical wonder that's involved here, where God literally opens a sea. Now, some people argue it was there by the shallow part of the Red Sea where there were reeds and things you can go and see on the internet. It wasn't, because how did all the horses drown and Pharaoh's choice men and an entire army? You don't drown in water this deep. God opened a sea. It's like going down to the beach here, putting your staff in the river, and the sea opens like a few hundred meters up either side. That's the type of miracle God was doing here. And an entire nation passes through. The Egyptians chase after them, and God basically closes out, and he wipes out all the army. Now, would you say after 10 plagues and splitting of a sea, it's perhaps the appropriate response to write and sing a song about God's greatness? Can you understand why context is such an important thing? And that's why I say then is the most important. Then they wrote and they sang this song. If you've been through something like this and you've seen God doing wonders like this, you would respond in praise of how great God is, how massive he is to deliver us. To my last slide there quickly. You know, we've recently relocated to Franschhoek, our HQ office. And so I get to do the beautiful drive from Stellenbosch to Franschhoek every day. It's over the Halswichte Pass there. And so I get about a half an hour there and back each day in the car. And one of the things that I've been doing a lot lately is listening to the audio Bible. And so kind of as I was working through the story and preparing this message, I was just listening to the story over and over and over again, just the story of the Exodus. And I, like I said earlier, and I was like, Lord, why were you so hard on the Egyptians? You know, it kind of, I wouldn't say that it seems unfair, because God isn't unfair. God is God, and he's just in all his ways, and his ways are above our ways. And you know, the answer to that question is actually there. And as I'm reading through it, God is, he's clearly saying it in the word. The reason why I'm striking this nation so hard is, number one, to show my might. He says it in the word. This is basically a showdown between God and a hardened heart and a nation. And basically God is saying, I'm going to flex my muscles and you're going to see. Okay? He doesn't do it often in the Bible where he waar hy so sterk optree teenoor mense, but this is one of them. And he's making a point. And he's saying, you will see my wonders. I will make a point of showing you who I am. And that's why we have plagues like we've never seen before. And that's why we have the splitting of the seas. We haven't read about many more splittings of the seas. There was a time when God made a point of showing his strength. The second reason, he says, I'm judging the occult of the nation of Egypt. The sorcery that's going on, the magic that's going on, the gods that they are serving, the wickedness, the idolatry, he says, I'm judging it. You're going to go read it. That's the second reason. But the third reason, and perhaps the most important in the context of this morning's message, it clearly says he's doing all of this so that they will have a story to tell their children. So that they will have a story to tell the children. Remember, this message is called Becoming Storytellers. And so I want to come back just in closing to these three verses. We read Psalm 78 where Asaph is saying, open your ears, I've got a story to tell. I will utter dark sayings of old. Verse 1 and 2. Verse 3, he says, verse 3 to 6, he says, which we have heard and known and our fathers have told us. Verse 4, we will not hide them from their children, telling to the generation to come the praises of the Lord. Verse 5, that they should make them known to their children. Verse 6, that they may arise and declare them to their children. You see, Asaph is urging us here to become storytellers. He's using a lot of scripture real estate in the context of this message to make this point. And he's saying, I want you to become storytellers. I want you to become storytellers of the story, of the Bible, and of the stories that I'm giving you. He's making that point. And people, you know, when it comes to the story, the Bible, you know, we don't read the Bible the right way anymore. And that's why I was so blessed by Norbert's message this morning in the offering. He took time to give us context and not just give us one little verse. You know, these days we have snack verses. You know, the feel-good verses, you know. We even subscribe to websites where the apps send us a nice little feel-good verse for the day and you feel blessed because you got your one little verse. The Bible was not meant to be read as little snack verses here and but the nice little bits. That's not the Bible. The Bible is written in books. It's chronicles. It's letters. It's epistles. It's a letter. You can't just read one part of the letter. The letter needs to be read in entirety. So when you read the Bible, you must read at least a chapter, or best of all, take a half an hour, 20 minutes, read the book. Then you're going to understand the context. But we don't read the Bible like that anymore. What's worse is we don't teach our children about the Bible anymore. And so, ek het 'n 5-jarige seentjie, sy naam is William, and you know, he loves the word. He's on his second Bible. And the reason why he's on his second Bible is because the first one is gedaan. Hy's klaar. Hy's flenters. Hy's vol duct tape. Ons het hom, hy was klein toe hy begin lees het, so he used to get excited in the beginning and then, you know, turn the pages and then a couple of pages would go flying. But he knows that first little Bible. We've still got that Bible. It's basically a duct tape Bible now. But then we bought him a next little Bible, kind of a step up, kind of intermediary little kids Bible. But it's a 450-page decent kids Bible, you know. And we on round two. He's been through his Bible. He's 5 years old. And we've made an effort to tell him the story of the story. You know what I'm saying? It's sometimes I say to the guys, it's the last thing I want to do at night. I've kind of had a hard day at the office and now you've bathed the kids and you're tired and all you want to do is just go and eat your meal and you know, chill with your wife at the bottom. But you make the choice to invest in his discipleship. And so we read Bible every night. So I want to encourage you guys to become storytellers of the story to your children. That's what Asaph is saying there. That's what he's saying. Tell them the stories. Tell them the stories of what God has done. They must know about the Egyptenare and the prince of Egypt and everything, David and Goliath. They must know all these amazing stories that our kids must know from young. But we need to become the storytellers. That's what Asaph is saying to us in verse 3 to 6 there. He's saying, tell those stories to the generations to come. Tell them of what I've done. That's why God said, I'm going to do these things so that they've got stories to tell. So tell them the story, but tell them your story as well. You know, we've all got stories. And you see, what happens is when we share, as mama and papa, when you kind of sit and say, you know, this is what God did for us, or this is what God, how God came through for us, we build memorials in their hearts that they remember. Because mom and dad told them those stories. You know what? They remember those stories their whole lives, and then they tell those stories to their kids. And they say, weet jy wat met oupa en ouma gebeur het? Dit en dit. En toe het God so deurgekom vir hulle. And those memorials last generations. That's what Asaph is talking about here. He's saying, tell them about the word of God, what God has done for them. And secondly, tell them about the memorials that I am giving you to speak about, to become storytellers about. Amen? So we are called to be storytellers. And, yeah, you know, as the band comes up, I'm wanting us to challenge, or I'm wanting to challenge us this morning. I said this is going to be a worship and testimony service, and this is where the testimony part comes in. What I'm wanting you to do is, in the row that you're sitting, you find somebody that you don't necessarily know that well. You can know them because I think everybody knows each other here. Perhaps that you don't know that well. You got 3 minutes to tell them one story that's happened in your life, or one story in the Bible that's significant to you, that means something to you. So we're going to exercise what we've heard. We're going to start. We're going to become storytellers right now. And then we're going to have communion in a second. But let's do what Asaph said we must do. Let's become storytellers. So let's take 2 or 3 minutes. You turn to somebody in your row. We're going to just take a few minutes and you share one story. It can be a story of deliverance, a story of God's goodness, His provision, something that's happened at work this week. And let's become storytellers right now. Let's do that.